actually, this the title of this talk sort of presumes that the web of things exists. Okay? I should make a caveat at the very beginning. I think at the end of the talk, I will expect your opinion about whether or not this is something that's really possible, something that's really plausible, or something that we will do simply because we can, not necessarily because we have any particular good reason for doing it. So I'd like your opinion on those things. I wanted to say, too, I know some of my students have seen this slide, at least, is that for some of you who know me in the past, some of the talks that I've given in this series, I truly dislike the term Web 2.0 because I don't feel that the web has version numbers and it's everything that we really see is part of the evolution of the web. So what I decided to do in this particular slide is, if that is a common characteristic that some people think about it, I decided to carry it to an extreme of not even having just Web 2.0, but having things like Web 2.5 and 2.6, etc. But basically, I think what I've tried to demonstrate in this slide is really what we've seen in terms of the evolution of the web. Especially toward the bottom is really where it's been getting exciting, where you've got the mobile web, the semantic web, which we've had talks about, and the data web, which we've also had talks about. And so the question then is, what is next? There's a lot of discussion. There has been a lot of discussion in recent years about the Internet of Things, or the web of things, or the Internet of Objects, or the web of objects, and you can come up with just about any sort of combination you can think of. So that's why I say yada, yada, yada. And you always have the question, too, you know, is this just some kind of buzz? Is this just something that journalists can write about? Or people can have conferences about? Is there really something substantive to these particular concepts? Do they really have, you know, do they really represent what the web is going to mean or what the web is going to move towards? Okay. The important thing now when we talk about this, and this is probably part of the reason why this discussion has arisen, is that we clearly now have the capability to connect and integrate everyday devices and objects on the web. You know, objects perhaps that we didn't really think about doing before, you know, like our mobile phones or other kinds of things. And we already, I think, see ourselves using these objects in some ways, maybe using the web or not, in ways that several years ago we could have never imagined. Okay? And so, is this what we can expect to see in a so-called web of things? Now, one of the courses that I enjoy teaching, that I've taught in the past, is human-computer interaction. I used to do that as part of this program, but that course kind of disappeared. But there's an interesting concept in human-computer interaction called the model human-computer. And the whole idea behind the model human-computer is it tries to take outside objects, especially computing objects, and match them up with physical entities. You know, for example, hard drives are like your long-term memory, or tactile response, or even the visual thing. So this tries to really say one way that we can define people's interactions with computing is to try to come up with this one-to-one correspondence between human characteristics. Okay? And I would say that that worked fine. It worked fine as long as it was one person and one computer. It worked fine when we really all we were trying to map in that case were sort of our five senses, or at least some subset of those, because those were really what we expected that we would be interacting with computers with. And I also say that that was at a time when computer architecture was pretty simple. And so it was easy to make that mapping. However, my feeling now is, in reality, there's only one computer. We can think about the internet as being this huge computer that we're all connected to, and we all have a little view into, right? And the great thing about this computer is it never goes down. It always is up. Okay? It has basically infinite resources. And so basically, its processing then and its data potential is limitless. And so what we clearly see in that case is that the five human senses that worked fine in the human computer model, now we're dealing with more than five senses. You know, we see this all the time. You know, we hear about smart houses and smart rooms, things that we interact with indirectly rather than explicitly, like in the model of human computer. And the other thing we see in this reason why this model doesn't necessarily work so well is we're no longer the only entities that are using this computer. It's not something that's just for humans. Okay? Machines talk to each other. Machines share data with each other. So we need to come up with a model that is better or is more modern or is more appropriate than the model of human computer used to be. Okay, so when we talk about a web of things, you know, we ask ourselves the question, what is it, first off, and why should we do it? So in other words, what problems can it solve? What does it look like architecturally? How do we put it together? What are the things that we want to connect? And what is the glue that connects these things together? And if we think about it once again, like a computer, what kinds of applications, what kind of programs, what kind of services can we build on top of a web of things? I mean, we've certainly seen in the case of the web, our normal perception of the web, that a lot of web services, web applications, have got great power with respect to its architecture, you know, the client-server model. But if we have a web of things, what kinds of applications and services can be defined for it? Okay? So here's my vision, or my perception, for the web of things. So I would say that clearly the web has totally changed the way we communicate. Right? The way we communicate with each other. Totally revolutionized it. Okay? So everything, not just us, everything are objects. And the question might be, how do we, it's just an issue of knowing how to communicate with those objects, or if it's appropriate to communicate with those objects. So to me, a web of things becomes an interactive universe of things, objects, data, ideas, concepts, etc., that are both real and might also be virtual, might not be real. You know, ideas and concepts aren't necessarily real, hard entities. But there's no reason to believe that we cannot interact with ideas and concepts. Okay, the other point that I have here is that experts estimate that by the end of 2012, physical sensors are going to generate 20% of non-video internet traffic. These aren't people that are generating this. So what's that data for, and how can that data be used? So the web of objects possibly defines one notion about how they can be integrated together using the internet, using the web, in order to create goods, services, applications, etc., that we don't have now. And one could think, there's a lot of discussion about singularity, you know, that point at which mankind and machines converge. This could be, in some ways, one vision or one way in which we might see something approaching this idea of singularity. Okay, we talked about interactions. So what kind of interactions do we have? We have interactions between people. We have interactions between objects. Okay. People to objects. And some of these interactions, I would say, you know, may involve a mediary. There may be something that's acting in between. But not necessarily. Okay? And we could say in that case that typically when we have these, like, you know, the sensors in this room, or something that you have, for example, like a photoelectric cell that opens a door for you, that's an interaction between you and an object. They typically rely on senses that have a limited range. Clearly, I walk up to the door and the door opens. It has a very limited range. Given the nature of the web, we then could say, okay, that range of potential interaction between people and objects, or objects and objects, or people and people and people, we've already seen that communication between people and people is now universal. So what would it mean to have then a universal intercommunication between people and objects? And in most of these instances, we can say, just like in the case of the rise of object data, is that things or objects become transmitters, and we also have then receptors, might be objects, might be people, who can either initiate communication, and they respond to stimuli. So in this way, it is sort of like a human-computer model, but on a bigger way. The human-computer model talked about how our five senses respond to stimuli. Now what we're trying to do is come up with a more general model about what an interaction means. All right? We also would say that in communications, that by definition, communication has intent. All right? So that means that we can say that objects and things are named objects. We can identify them uniquely. We won't say how, but you might be able to guess when we're talking about the web. That objects and things have attributes. That's what makes them interesting. If they didn't have attributes, if they didn't have characteristics, we wouldn't really be interested in them. And the way that you express intent is by representing objects and things and their attributes. You know, I want to know about something, so I'm actually querying its attributes. So that's how this communication really now involves intent. Okay, so a lot of this stuff, a lot of these ideas are not really new. They've been around for a while. It's part of the whole idea that you often hear about as far as ubiquitous computing, computing on demand, computing as a utility, computing as a resource, pervasive computing. Captology, if some of you aren't familiar with that, is basically the use of computing to influence people's decisions or opinions, some of which is explicit and some of which is implicit. So we're clearly familiar then with sensors and RFIDs. And as Paul actually suggested too, there's been discussions, or at least there's been some kind of hidden thought, even from the beginning of the web, which once again I sarcastically represent as Web 1.0, that people have thought about what does it mean. And as an example of that, some of you may remember that in the early days there was this so-called coffee pot on the web. Everybody thought that this was very cool. You know, this was in Cambridge in 1991. Okay, and the idea was, of course, then you could see if there was any coffee in the coffee pot from your office. And if there wasn't, you just waited until somebody else made coffee because you didn't want to have to go there and make it yourself. So you could say that in some ways there was definitely an interaction, and that interaction was designed to satisfy a particular intent. Namely, you wanted to know if there was some coffee for you to get, right? But was this coffee pot really on the web? Sort of a nice idea. But I said no. I say no. Why do I say no? Because right here I talked about it, really this thing was sort of the inspiration for the first webcam. It still required my interaction visually to know what was happening there. That coffee pot was really not talking to me. It was not really interacting to me. It wasn't even interacting with the camera. What I was doing is I was interacting with the video that I got from the camera. So was this really on the web? I would say no. Why? Because we don't have that level of communication between objects and the intent that we would like to have. I'll quickly go through this. I mean, even now, all of this discussion about a web of things, you know, talk about there's a lot of buzz. People love the idea. So people have created sort of a vocabulary for it already. You know, so for example, there's so-called blobjects. And the idea of a blobject is an object that blogs, not necessarily a human. So in fact, you know, maybe this coffee pot, if it had the capability, could actually write a blog or tweet or something of that nature. There are so-called spimes, which are basically, once again, a location-aware object that really can give information about itself and its environment. Okay? And we're seeing these kinds of things, once again, as being possible through technologies such as RFID and two-dimensional barcoding and just dumping this data onto the internet, you know, to create some kind of informational space of data that's generated by objects. Okay, that sounds good. It's good that people come up with terminologies, but, you know, is something like this really happening? All right. Now, let's go even more specific. So, what does it mean if you say that a person is on the web? I mean, probably everybody in here considers themselves to be on the web. I mean, you use it. You might have a web page. You know, you might have a presence on Facebook or something of that nature. What does that mean to say that a person is on the web? Well, my contention is it doesn't mean those kinds of things. It doesn't mean that you're just a homepage, because you're more than a homepage. It doesn't mean that you've got a database entry somewhere that gives particulars about you. That someone can pull up. Why? Because you're not providing that information. What does it mean? I would contend that could we get to the point where a person on the web really means a sensory sensitive, complete, unambiguous representation of a person. Right? So in other words, I say it's the ultimate example of the Turing test, in the sense that if I were to communicate, say, with Paul as a person on the web, I would have all of the same experience that I would have communicating with him in person. To me, that's what a person on the web means. And what good is this? Because in that particular way, you know, basically, if you can capture this kind of information about an individual, then you can only imagine the ways in which it could be potentially used. Is everybody okay? Everybody's eyes might be sort of glazed over at this point. Okay. So how do we do this? Well, maybe it's not so difficult. Maybe we just haven't thought about it from the right direction. So if we talk about a few premises, there's a lot of discussion now about really what computer science is. You know, is computer science a man-made discipline? simply because we designed the machines. Okay? We defined the protocols and the formats. Well, a lot of people would like to see the definition of computer science expanded because they recognize the fact that really everything that's happening in nature, everything that's happening in the universe is processing data. So that means that it goes a lot further than just the man-made devices. So we know that nature is, in fact, a data processing machine, right? We also have found that maybe the best engineering that we can do emulates nature. When people designed airplanes, they looked at animals that fly, right, and learned from them. And the other thing is that also I would contend that in the past, just like the model human computer, we've always thought about the internet. We've always used this comparison with the human brain. And in my particular opinion, that's getting a little old. Is that we are really talking about capabilities and infrastructures and models and communication that is beyond something that we can place a one-to-one correspondence with as far as brain activity. Right? So, for example, here's an example of nature. You know, as Paul mentioned, I'm an old physicist. So I consider something like... you didn't say old. You know, consider something like, you know, gauge theory. You know, basically, if you don't know what that means, that doesn't matter. But you know, you do know that if you have two charged objects, right, there's things that happen between them. If they're the same charge, they repel each other. If they are opposite charges, they attract each other. And we don't really know how that happens, but somehow those objects know. Somehow those objects are able to exchange hard data. Okay? I would say in nature, you could say hard data is this whole thing like femurones. You know, people don't recognize it, but, you know, clearly now the perfume manufacturers take advantage of things like that. So they can exchange hard data, and they can also exchange so-called soft data, you know, like body language or visual clues or things like that. Consider those in nature. And so the issue then is that how do we receive information? How can we communicate information then about objects and or about concepts, you know, using something like this, right? And I used, you know, field theory or gauge theory, you know, as an example of a natural model. It's clearly doing something according to natural laws. But if you look at that particular diagram, you know, it's not a lot different from this, right? It's not a lot different between, say, two objects on a wireless network communicating with each other. The big difference, however, is what are they communicating to each other? You know? How are they communicating to each other? What kind of information? What kind of cues? What kind of intentions are they communicating with each other? Okay? And clearly, just like field theory, all these things have a range. All of these things don't necessarily interact with one another. There's rules. So, for example, in our previous one, if you have a particle that has no charge, it doesn't obey any of those rules. So we can apply rules to them in the same way. So why can't, if we think about nature as a good model, why can't we take this sort of idea and apply it to an engineering model, or specifically the web model? Okay? Now, some of my class saw this picture before, you know, but presented in a slightly different way. there was recently a conference in San Francisco called the Dreamforce Conference, and one of the major sponsors was Salesforce.com. They're a big CRM, customer relationship management company. And Mark Benioff is the chairman of Salesforce. And one of the examples that he used is that he walked outside in the convention center and he went up to a Coke machine. Right? Now, that Coke machine has probably been there for 15, 20 years. It's an old Coke machine. However, what his particular point was is that with his mobile phone knows through its GPS where he is. Coca-Cola presumably knows where its machines are. So now then, you could actually extrapolate the fact that Mark is standing next to a Coca-Cola machine. Okay? That's part of it. Now, on the other hand, Mark is in Facebook, and Mark is a fan of Coca-Cola in Facebook. So, if you put that other data together, then this machine could implicitly know that not only is Mark next to it, but he likes Coca-Cola, and maybe in particular he likes Coke Zero. So implicitly, could you say then that this Coke machine is on the web? Because it's relaying information, you know, not necessarily information strictly, it's not just broadcasting information about itself. It is part of a network where it is exchanging, in some ways involved in the information transfer between itself or its physical location and him in terms of what kind of soft drinks he likes. So, you know, logically, wouldn't you, can you say that even though this isn't connected to the internet, it's actually sort of on the web, right? And here's another one. This is sort of a nice gimmick. Here's some RFID powered shoes that connect with social media, right? So I've got these shoes, they've got an RFID in them, and I go and I step on this thing, and it tells my friends in Facebook where I am, right? Now that's a clever gimmick. That's a clever idea. Is this mean that these shoes are on the web? Well, I don't think it really does in that case. You could say, well, okay, it's an interesting thing. It certainly works with social media. You certainly could use it as part of supply chain management or inventory management because you can figure out where these shoes are. But does it really put the shoe on the web? Or does it put the chip that's in the shoe on the web? Wouldn't it be better to actually have information about the shoe as opposed to information about the chip that's in the shoe? It's not just a shoe with a chip. It's what we want. Right? So is this really an object on the web? Oh, not really. But it's a nice gimmick. Now, ideally, what we would want is it for we would want a real embedded web server in that shoe. And in that way, then, the shoe becomes, I would say, a first-class citizen on the web. If it's got its own IP address, it becomes a resident of the web or the internet. And then it also, if it's a server, it has the ability then to transmit and receive data. This is basically just one of the formats in which it might do that. It's again talking about semantic formats. Right? So to me, this is really what that shoe on the web would look like. Now, I say here that you think that's dumb. But it's only dumb, I would contend, because right now we can't necessarily think about why anybody would want to do that. And I would contend in this, like I say here, is that that's been the whole history of IT. Coming up with a technology that people would say, why do that? And we've seen a lot of those kinds of ideas and technology really take off. So ideally, that's what a shoe on the web might look like. All right? So, what we're meaning, and we said already that we're moving towards a period where we have a lot of machine-generated information. So, you know, in the past, we can always think, okay, the web has really relied on manual input of data. But in the future, we're going to have new information created, a flood of information that's created that does not involve any sort of human input, doesn't use that human computer model, right? And clearly then, the next generation, I think, that we'll see of sensors, is they're going to be able to have, are they going to have capabilities that we cannot, even at this particular point, imagine. All right. So, what are some of the web of things use cases? Well, once again, I would contend that anything that involves, you know, management of large systems. We're already seeing some things like this. You know, for example, this bottle of water has a barcode on it. And that's probably because at this particular point, you know, RFID chips have not become cheap enough to put on things like bottles of water. But they probably will at some point. And even chips that perhaps have some processing capability. So even in a commercial case, would it be interesting to really know if I was the owner of this company, I could tell where every one of these bottles is in the world. Okay? Academic use cases. You could think about in that, tracking students. Now, of course, all of this comes down to this notion about, you know, there may be clearly rooms for abuse and security and privacy and other issues. But once again, it's not too hard to think of cases where having non-human entities or non-just simple data providers on the web could have great functionality. Okay. All right, I want to quickly hear and talk a little bit about the architecture. Okay? And I think that the web of things clearly has a vertical architecture, which indicates the way in which it can be put together, the objects, the receivers, and the glue that ties them together. So basically then you can see at the very beginning is applications, web publishing. You know, applications are publishing data, data processing, data storage. These certainly could be a part of the RFID on the shoe. Data collection, embedded software, communication technology. How does it do that? Embedded devices and physical objects. Now, that doesn't suggest that an object on the web has to have really all of those characteristics in this architecture. Okay, so let's come up with a quick sort of example here. And what this might be, something very convenient. Very often, I know in Hong Kong, they have, you know, you can go and you can look at traffic on the web. Usually that's a webcam. That's just like this coffee machine, right? All you're really seeing is what this webcam is seeing. Now, once, suppose you really had the entities there talking to you. So suppose you had these sensors that were on a light pole. Okay? So if we examine all of the kinds of applications that might get, you know, you might want to know about what traffic today is. How does it publish? It could send out an RSS feed. That's a legitimate format for transmission of data on the web. Its processing could simply be done by any sort of event processing software. Data storage, this is going to be something maybe that the utility company keeps up, et cetera, all those different objects. If you're not familiar with 6-Load WPAN, that's basically Internet 6 low-powered personal area network, which is an IETF standard. Okay? So you can now see that for something like this, envision that you had a sensor that was up on a light pole monitoring traffic data, that really then it can, in fact, satisfy sort of this generic stack of applications, which then would literally put this object on the web. All right? Now, as I said, it could get simpler. No, so for example, I said, what does it mean if you have a person on the web? So you don't necessarily have to have all of those same capabilities. So for example, here the application might be my status page. I don't mean my Facebook status page. I could say I publish in HTML, and you can see then that I'm basically using these other kinds of technologies in order to transmit information about myself. Now, what is the kind of information might that be? That might be something that my doctor's interested in because he's monitoring my blood pressure. That puts me on the web. Okay? That puts information about me on the web in a far richer way than just a homepage that shows a picture of me and my kids and whatever kinds of stuff that you typically see on people's homepages. All right. So, if you take that stack that I had and then sort of break it up in categories, then you can see that here are the applications and services. This is how you're going to use the objects. Here's the glue. Here's the things that ties them together with the things. Right? And so, once again, taking our model then with the light pole, you know, we can see that we have the services, we have the things that tie those services to the web, and we have the things. With that architecture, then we could clearly put anything on the web. Right? Microcontroller with sensors, once again, assumes that it's not just a simple RFID device. It actually, in that way, is a miniature computer. Now, is that a silly idea? Absolutely not. Consider this phone and consider the capabilities of this phone, right? I carry this phone about me in my pocket. This phone can communicate with the internet. If I step outside of this room and I fall down the stairs, this phone's going to know it because it's got an accelerometer in it. If I lie down flat on the floor or run from one side of the room to the other, it knows it because it knows my geolocation. So this device is already a sensor that is capable of collecting, processing, and transmitting a great deal of rich information about me. So this is one of my collection devices, as it were, that could put me on the web. Right? So once again, the things. And I already used the, you know, an embedded device inside of a physical object. It could be a sensor. It could be the example I had, like a mobile phone, right? Or your pacemaker or something like that. So really, it could be lots of different combinations of things that collect data, but then adding to them their capability to process, share, and share that data. All right. Well, here's basically just a few definitions. I won't go through this in the interest of time, but physical objects, sensors, embedded systems, and sensor nodes. And I already mentioned this. So here's basically when we talk about a sensor node. This was what I'm talking about sort of distinguishes it from the idea where we typically have of an RFID, is that we've got some sort of sensor at the very bottom. It has processing power and data storage, and it has some mechanism for communication. And typically in that case, maybe it has some kind of power source. And that power source could be any number of mechanisms or technologies. Like the phone pole could clearly be something that was, say, a solar power source or something of that nature. And so we can really come up then with a lot of common types for sensors. So I talked about the glue. The key parts to the glue is the communication, any sort of node-centric programming that has to happen, because we said that we want to do processing, and we say that we want to do data collection. And so that basically means we're talking about, and we wanted to run a web server, so we are talking literally in this case about programming. We're talking about operating systems or virtual machines. Okay? We're talking about macro programming in that sense, depending upon, once again, the kind of data that we want to have collected. Okay? So once again, that's this part of that vertical stack for the object on the web that we talked about in that case. Applications and services. Now, here's the interesting thing here, is that typically now when you're thinking about collecting all this data, what are you going to do with it? The example that I had before was talking about using RSS. So that basically is not typically intended as a single source of data. So I think basically in talking about collecting data and somehow mashing it up, taking data from a lot of different sources, that was the whole idea in Web 2.0 about mashing up data. But typically it was talking about mashing up data coming from different web servers or coming from different services like Google Maps or something like that. Now, all of a sudden, with objects on the web, you know, you can only imagine all the possibilities that you have for mashing up data. You know, so that's where we talk about this universal communication in that sense. Okay? One of the things that's going to make this happen, then, is the need for sensor standards. You know, whenever you're talking about objects communicating with each other all over the world, you've got to have standards. And a lot of this effort has already started. It's going to make, then, these sensors, even developed from a wide variety of manufacturers, be able to communicate with each other. And basically, then, what does that mean in some ways is that you're creating what could be called, then, a sensor web. Not a person web, not a data web, but a web of sensors that are communicating with each other, right? And they're using a standard protocol, just the same way the web uses standard protocols. That's what makes the web work. So you could do the same thing in terms of these sensor webs. And once again, remember that what the internet is and what the web is are simply architectures for tying separate networks or separate webs together. So now we could take such sensor webs and incorporate it in the perception of the web that we have now. Right? Already there are efforts on what is called the sensor web enablement standards. All right? So, once again, that's the idea. Now, my major interest in this, or involvement in this, is the fact, if you look at the second bullet, this is being perceived as an extension of web standards. So it's basically saying that one of the ways, one of the optimal ways in which objects on the web can communicate data with each other are through web standards, namely XML-type data, using identifying objects by means of URIs, which is basically just another term for URL in that sense. So now all of these sensors actually have unique addresses. We already saw a hint of that when we talked about 6LoWPAN, because 6 is referring to the broader range of IP addresses that we can have in Internet 6. So we're already seeing that in this kind of thing. And already you've got groups that are working on the development of these kinds of standards. And I've taken some of the diagrams that they have. And these are, once again, things that have been talked about a long time, just like the coffee pot on the web. You know, what does it mean to have your appliances on the web? Okay? What ways might this appliance be able to broadcast information about itself that could possibly be used in the kind, and not just have, you know, something that says, but literally remember the old notions that you hear sometime, is that this thing tells you you need to go buy milk. You know, somehow it's going to have to figure out that you don't have any milk in there. This is not as simple as just saying it telling you what the temperature happens to be if your power goes off. That really then you can create smart appliances that are able in this sense to really transmit an unlimited amount of information about themselves. Somewhere in every appliance there is going to be a set of all of its characteristics, all of its measurable characteristics. So all of that data could be put on the web. Right? So here you have basically then the web-enabled home. Right? So, hey, where are my keys? Right? This isn't like the late-night TV things in the States, you know, where you clap and your keys tell you where they are, you know. Really, in this case, you're communicating with your keys. You're communicating with inanimate objects because they know their location. So, I mean, like right now, I could clap and my keys could beep, but I still have to figure out where in the room they are. Okay? And once again, we're already seeing examples like this. I lose this iPhone here, and I can go online, and it'll tell me where it is. It'll give me the GPS coordinates of where it is. So this isn't science fiction. Some of these things are happening now, but the question is, how can I expand those things? The other thing I can do with my iPhone, of course, if it gets stolen, I can tell it, I can find out where it is, and I can erase it. So whoever steals it can't get my files. That means that this object is really on the web. Challenges clearly have to do with scaling, discovery, how do we find services? These are all like web services. Performance, standardization, we said. And clearly, how do we manage these huge data sets? We're clearly talking about, you know, several orders of magnitude of data than we have now. And, you know, here's sort of an architecture about the way in which you do it. So, for example, that how, in fact, an object might collect data, process the data, in other words, put it together in, you know, particular formats for transmission and things like this. So architectures like this, you know, are very well defined. There's no really mystery here. And as far as the issue about the data, I think the last time, one of the other times I was here, I talked about the web of data, linked open data. That was that last item that we saw, is that now we're talking about not just websites, not just web pages, we're talking about data on the web, being able to directly access data. So there's a lot of effort already in how to deal with disparate data sets on the web. And clearly these kinds of semantic web technologies could push forward the adoption of something like a web of objects. Thank you very much.